Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
Drugs have done some good things for us. I really do. And if you don't believe drugs have done good things for us, do me a favor. Go home tonight, take all your albums, all your tapes, and all your CDs and burn them. Because you know what? The musicians who made all that great music that's enhanced your lives throughout the years? Real fucking high on drugs.
Bill Hicks with Tool, Third Eye. Thank you, Bill, for all you've left us. And today I have a great interview that I'm really excited about. Actually, they're all great interviews, and I'm always excited about all of them. But this one is very deep and very good. But before I get started with the interview for today, I'd like to say that my new book, The Holy Mushroom, is now shipping. For those of you who ordered copies in the last 2 weeks, your order is now on the way. And for those of you who have not ordered your copy yet, please feel free to get your copy in. I still have about 60 copies left for the first 100 numbered and signed. For those of you who want a copy, please go to GnosticMedia.com and pick one up there. That's GnosticMedia.com. As well, if you'd rather get one from Amazon.com, they are available from Amazon as of today. So check it out. And without further ado, here's my interview with Dr. Charles Grobe from Harbor UCLA Medical Center. Today I have a very exciting interview with someone who's a pioneering researcher in the field of psychedelic drugs, or what are today commonly referred to as entheogens. I'm going to be talking with Dr. Charles Grobe, MD, who is professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at Harbor UCLA School of Medicine. Is that correct?
Well, I'm actually a professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the UCLA School of Medicine and director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Harbor UCLA Medical Center.
All right, great. And let's see, you conducted the first government-approved study of MDMA, and you were the principal investigator of an international biomedical psychiatric research project in the Brazilian Amazon of the, it says plant here, I'll say brew ayahuasca.
Right.
You are currently conducting an investigation of the effects of psilocybin on anxiety in cancer patients. Dr.
Right.
Grobe has published numerous articles in medical and psychiatric journals and collected volumes and is the editor of Hallucinogens, a Reader. He is the founding member, or a founding member, of the Hefter Research Institute. And can you tell me a little bit about the Hefter Research Institute?
Oh, sure. The Hefter is a research institute devoted to funding and helping to develop research projects within academic medicine, psychiatry, and the neurosciences on psychedelics, an area that's been seriously neglected for many years. We're trying to help facilitate a new look using state-of-the-art research methodologies.
Well, you and I suppose it was last December, you and I were both in a film together, actually. It was called American Drug War, that was put out by Kevin Booth. And how did you get to be involved in Kevin's film?
Oh, well, I mean, a few years ago, I simply got a call from him asking, he could come by and talk. He said he had read about the research we were doing here, and he was interested and was beginning to put together a film and would be interested in talking with myself. And he also asked if he might be able to talk with one of my research subjects. And at that time, I had had a research subject who had completed the study. She had advanced cancer, and we treated her with psilocybin. It was all, approved, sanctioned research within our clinical research unit at Harbor UCLA Medical Center. And she was very eager to talk about her experiences, a very articulate woman. So Kevin came by and interviewed both my subject, Pam, and myself.
Very interesting. How did you get involved in this area of research?
Oh, involved with psychedelic research?
Yeah, the
in
whole
general?
Field.
Yeah, well,
yes.
I mean, I've been interested in this for a very long time. I grew up during the 1960s, where this was a high-profile issue, and so certainly was influenced by much of the discussion and the controversy at that time. I had the opportunity in the early 70s to read a lot of the literature that had been put together to date in psychiatric and medical and neuroscience journals on the range of effects of psychedelics, and I was very impressed with their potential to help us more fully understand the brain, the mind-brain interface, help us understand mental illness, and also help us to develop new and perhaps more effective treatment models. So I felt this was an area I'd like to be involved with. I actually told my father, who was a physician, that I was interested in developing this area as a career, and he reminded me that at that particular time I had dropped out of college and had no degrees, and he cautioned me that regardless of the merits of my ideas and my interests, that I would never get a fair hearing unless I had the adequate credentials. So at that point, I realized I needed to, if I was serious about working in this area, I'd have to go back to school and get all the essential credentials. So I went back initially to Columbia University, did all my pre-med, and then went to medical school, and then went into my training. And yeah, eventually I had the opportunity to develop some research protocols, although it took a very long time to get there.
So what makes UCLA different? What do they do that led you there and that allow you to do what you're doing?
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it is so different, but I came. I was recruited for my position at Harbor UCLA, and I was, because I'm an academic child and adolescent psychiatrist. In addition to my interest in psychedelics, I also have had a career now for the almost 25 years working as a child psychiatrist in academic settings. So I was recruited to be the director of the Division of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry at Harbor UCLA, but I was very upfront with the chairman at that time, Dr. Milton Miller, that I had these interests, which might be a bit unusual for a child psychiatrist. So I told him what my interests were. I gave him material that I had written, some articles I had published, some protocols I had written that I said I'd like to do someday, and he was very receptive. In fact, Dr. Miller had been around in the late 50s and early 60s when he was the chairman at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, and was very knowledgeable of the research that had existed at that time. He himself had been involved in some treatment of very difficult resistant cases with psychedelics, had seen some good effects, and felt there clearly was merit. So it was not at all disturbed by these interests that I had. So he was very, very supportive. Now he subsequently became ill, and a couple of years ago he passed away. But the current chairman, the new chairman, Dr. Lesser, who had previously been the training director, was also very, very, very supportive. So I've had a lot of personal support from my chairman at Harbor UCLA.
And you've been
but I would say my sense is, you know, that in today's world, it's more feasible to consider investigating these compounds under, you know, rigorously controlled sanctioned conditions in academic centers. I think we've gotten beyond that point in time where it would be perceived as a career liability. I think it's psychedelic research is being viewed upon with more respect and greater, far greater interest than perhaps 20, 30 years ago.
And you've been researching in entheogens for what, about 40 years now?
Well, no. I mean, I've had an interest going back, you know, a long time. But in regard, I think the first article and protocol I wrote were about 20 years ago. And, you know, the MDMA study started in, and the ayahuasca study both were in 93. So since then, I've been actively conducting, you know, approved research in this area.
So what benefits do you seek from pursuing what many people construe as controversial research?
Well, again, these are extraordinarily potent compounds in regards to their action on the brain, on perception, on thought construction, on our sense of who we are. And they've also been demonstrated to potentially have a significant range of efficacy as therapeutic modalities, particularly in conditions that are not that responsive to conventional treatments. I mean, there's a number of presentations in psychiatry that for which we do not have very effective treatments. First and foremost, treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction. There's also the treatment of severe chronic post-traumatic stress disorder, treatment of severe refractory obsessive compulsive disorder, and then the work that we've been doing more recently, which would be treating people with advanced life-threatening cancer who have associated anxieties, serious levels of existential anxiety. You know, if you control optimally the conditions within which you administer the psychedelic compound and properly screen and prepare people, you know, there is a range of therapeutic effects that might emerge that I believe at the very least needs to be explored for both safety and efficacy. So so what was considered not possible a few decades ago is now possible to you know, it's possible to get permission, it's possible to get essential funding, and it's possible to successfully conduct these studies in supportive academic institutions.
Well, a lot of the things that you just mentioned, I hope to touch on more as we progress through the interview here. So,
But
next I wanted to ask you, you studied MDMA, is that correct?
Right.
And that's known as the street drug ecstasy.
Ecstasy, yeah. It's 3,4-methylenedioxymethamphetamine, or MDMA, also known as ecstasy.
And
although not, I should add, not all ecstasy is MDMA. There's a, in regards to, you know, the black market ecstasy, there's a appreciable percentage of ecstasy which turns out to be compounds other than MDMA. There's a lot of drug substitution going on out in the world, so I always mention that around the topic of ecstasy.
Can you tell me about your studies into MDMA?
Sure. Yeah, well, we had in the early 90s, we had the first FDA-approved study where we were allowed to give pure synthetic MDMA to research volunteers. I think we treated 18 people. Normal volunteers, adults, and we examined the range of physiological and psychological effects at different dosage levels, and published our papers. We found that by and large, most of our subjects tolerated the MDMA quite well. We had two individuals who did have high blood pressure reactions, who did have brief transient hypertensive reactions, which we were able to bring down quickly. But, you know, that's a cautionary note about blood pressure regulation. But otherwise, people tolerated the experience well physiologically. Psychologically, we only had one individual who reported adverse psychological experience, and this was the model was we had people come in on three separate occasions, spaced a few weeks apart. We treated them on the clinical research unit here. Two of the sessions were different dosages of MDMA. One of the sessions was an inactive placebo. It was double blind, so neither myself, my staff, nor the subject knew what they were getting on any one occasion, and it was randomized. You didn't necessarily know what order they were going to get them. So we had this one individual come in for his very first session. So it was a 1 in 3 possibility he would get either one of two different MDMA dosages or a placebo. Midway through the session, he reported a great deal of anxiety and kind of emotional turmoil. He told us that he felt taking the MDMA in a room on the clinical research unit was a very inhospitable setting, and felt that he was picking up on what he described as all the negative vibes in the hospital. And we heard him out and were very supportive. And we also told him that if he did not want to return for the next two experimental sessions, he could always drop out of the study. We told him he did have to spend that night in the hospital, because that was part of the protocol that he had agreed to, and it was for safety reasons. We didn't want him driving out after having been administered a compound, but he was free to leave the next morning, did not have to come back, and he elected to drop out of the study. He decided not to pursue the next two sessions. So since he had dropped out, we decided to break the blind to see how much of the MDMA he had been administered that had precipitated this serious anxiety reaction. And we found, to our utter amazement, that he had actually been administered a placebo. So never underestimate the power of the placebo response. But otherwise, we had 18 other people, each of whom had, in addition to their placebo session, two MDMA sessions, and no one else had an adverse psychological experience.
Well, so how dangerous is MDMA compared with other psychoactive substances, and what about compared to alcohol and, say, marijuana?
Well, I would say, when you look at their range of psychological and physiological effects, short term and long term, I think alcohol has more serious risks. I think it's been, and the assessments that have looked at. An investigator named Robert Gable did a comparative study going through the literature and looking at relative risk of a large number of compounds. He rated the dangers of MDMA as being below that of alcohol, but above that of cannabis.
Interesting. Would you say that most of the rumors floating out there and the media and things about the dangers of MDMA or ecstasy are correct, or are they just wild wives' tales?
Well, I mean, we have to be specific. There are some risks, some legitimate risks. There's a risk of high blood pressure responses, particularly for individuals who are vulnerable for. Who have labile blood pressure to begin with, or who may be on another compound that may interact with the MDMA and cause sustained blood pressure elevations, that can be dangerous. We know that there's a risk of severe temperature elevation that can create a condition called a malignant hyperthermia, which can lead to a dramatic and potentially catastrophic disseminated clotting in various blood vessels that has led to a number of deaths, but that seems to occur only within the context of individuals who are exercising a great deal, like at raves or clubs, dancing a lot, and who neglect to replace fluid. So there have been a modest number of fatalities there. There are some people do need to be aware that there are some relative risks, but there was the big controversy that existed, you know, over the last really since the mid 80s when it was first discussed publicly was the concern about neurotoxicity induced by MDMA, and there's a large body of preclinical investigative studies that have been published. There's also some clinical or human data on this. I've actually did a very thorough review of the data on neurotoxicity as it exists in the literature, and about seven years ago, I published it in a journal called Addiction Medicine. It's actually posted online at the MAPS website, so it's available. And after reviewing the literature, I felt there were very serious flaws in some of the reports, alleging neurotoxicity. There were serious problems in methodology, serious problems in data analysis, serious problems in how the findings were reported publicly. So in many respects, our group felt that it was the purported dangers were that the concerns about dangers were somewhat overblown in this regard, that there were too many flaws in the research that went into these reports. The most notorious example was a study given a great deal of press attention in the early 2000s out of Johns Hopkins, where monkeys were administered what was said to be MDMA, and they developed very, very serious degeneration of neurotransmitter systems in the brain, including the dopaminergic system. It was the first demonstration of not only serotonin damage, but also extensive dopamine system damage, and it was thought that this was indication that individuals who took MDMA were exposing themselves to later developing Parkinson's disorder, which is a disorder of the dopamine system. And even though there were some concerns about the reported methodology as it was reported, it was still the findings were accepted at face value by the field, and the concerns over MDMA neurotoxicity were given a lot of press attention. So there was this study in the very prestigious journal, Science, reporting in monkeys that not only did the investigators find evidence of serotonin damage, they also found evidence of extensive dopaminergic damage. It was given a great deal of attention in the press. The concern about MDMA neurotoxicity was circulating widely at that point. But almost exactly a year later, the journal Science reported a retraction from the authors of the study, stating that it was actually not MDMA that the monkeys were administered. It was rather methamphetamine, which would have been expected to have caused dopamine changes. So, that study was identified as being entirely without substance. But there are actually other concerns about other studies, not as dramatic as this, but still serious, consistent methodologic flaws and flaws in interpretation, that make the field rather problematic. So, in regards to what are the risks, the long-term risks of using MDMA, I would say for individuals who used it on only one occasion, there is. In all likelihood, minimal risk, as long as there was no blood pressure, hypertension crisis or something like that during the experience. But, for individuals who used it repeatedly for extensive periods of time, mixing it with other compounds, taking it in under adverse conditions, who knows? I'd say we don't know. But at least this notion that even one dose of MDMA on one occasion only could cause permanent brain damage. I think that's concerns about that have been tempered, have faded considerably.
So
that's my long answer.
So what do you feel?
And again, details are available in that article I wrote, which the MAPS website has on their site.
What do you feel about people out there who, are in the medical community? And I know one instance, there's a radio program out of Los Angeles that's been on for about 20 years or more called Loveline.
Right.
And the Dr. Drew is the host. And every time I've ever heard the show, he's been putting out false or wrong information on these substances. What do you think about that
sort of thing? Actually, he had me on it once. Yeah, I was on it. I was interviewed once for it. And I told him, I gave him my take in a kind of a version of what I just told you, and he seemed fairly receptive at that time. I don't know what else he's been saying.
Yeah.
But again, I think in the field there's a growing sense that the early concerns about neurotoxicity were somewhat overblown and sensationalized.
Well, going back, you mentioned earlier that MDMA has the MA part is methamphetamine. Could you talk about that and, what are the...
Structurally, from the chemical structure point of view, it has similarities to both, amphetamine and also the hallucinogen mescaline. So chemically, it's got some similarities to both. So there is a component which stimulates the system to some degree as an amphetamine would, but there's also a component which is somewhat hallucinogenic or allowing somewhat of a visionary experience, or at least an internal explorative experience. And MDMA also has some very unique qualities, such as this capacity to induce states of empathy, which is defined as the capacity to put yourself in the shoes of somebody else and really know what they're going through, really feel their feelings. And it's actually a higher order psychological function that MDMA, in a rather unique manner, seems to be able to reliably induce it when properly screened and prepared subjects take it under optimal conditions. So it's, again, got some similarities to amphetamine, some similarities to mescaline, but also some very unique qualities. People like Sasha Shulgin, who was instrumental in the early development of the compound felt it had a rather its rather unique profile made it quite suitable for a psychotherapy model in regards to the duration of action and also in regards to the its effects on feeling states and its capacity to enhance one's ability to articulate feelings, to put words to feelings.
So is there any risk with MDMA of addiction because of the methamphetamine?
No, physiologically, it's not an addictive compound. In fact, most users who elect to take it on a relatively frequent basis find that over a rather short period of time, some tolerance is developed. It loses its positive its range of positive effects. It's more likely to induce significant adverse effects such as energy depletion afterwards, lowered mood, and it's very unusual for people to take it repeatedly for prolonged periods of time. I do not. It's not physiologically addictive. Certainly, some individuals get psychologically dependent to the experience, but over time, it's not a compound which is seen as addictive.
Interesting, and that in and of itself is sort of the opposite of what's told on in the media.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of misunderstanding, I think, out there.
Yeah. Well, and that's why I wanted to have you on today, to clarify a lot of things and as we go through here. Well, you abandoned MDMA research into anxiety treatment for dying patients. What other medical applications do you see for MDMA?
Well, yeah, let me say, we initially proposed to do a study with terminal cancer patients with anxiety and MDMA, but elected to change the protocol to a different compound, psilocybin. There were two reasons for that. One was at the point in time we made this decision, the MDMA issue was being sensationalized in the press, and we felt it would be very hard to get an objective hearing on the relative merits of an MDMA therapeutic model. Now, the other reason was that we felt that when working with people who are dealing with very profound existential issues, like they're having an advanced medical illness and we're at high risk for not surviving very long, we're dealing with very core issues of life and death, that we felt that when you look at the old literature from the 50s and 60s, that the classic hallucinogens or classic psychedelics their range of action might be actually preferable to MDMA, that the classic hallucinogens often provided for a deeper in-depth experience that's more likely to lead to a transpersonal or transcendent psychospiritual epiphany, which we thought would be more likely to achieve the desired therapeutic outcome, or what we're looking for with these particular patients. So that's why we switched over from MDMA to psilocybin.
Okay, and
I can't quite recall the first part of your question there.
Well, I think you pretty well answered it. That's fine.
Okay.
You've done studies into ayahuasca, haven't you?
Oh, sure, yeah.
Could you tell me
different studies?
Could you tell me a little bit about those studies?
It were two studies. One was in 1993, one was in 2001. The first study was along with Dennis McKenna and Jace Calloway and some Brazilian collaborators. We were allowed to study members of a Brazilian syncretic ayahuasca church in the city of Manaus, in Amazonia, in Brazil. We studied individuals who had used ayahuasca for at least the previous 10 years, had been part of this syncretic church, União de Vegetal, or the UDV, And ayahuasca was taken as a psychoactive sacrament only within the context of their religious ceremonies. And there were ceremonies scheduled on the first and third Saturday evenings of every month, and additionally for particular religious holidays or for training purposes. We studied 15 long-term ayahuasca users, and we had 15 non-ayahuasca using controls. We worked them up along a number of different parameters, including their general medical health, general psychological health. We did structured psychiatric diagnostic interviews. We did personality testing, neuropsychological testing. As baselines, we also took a lot of blood from both groups, some of which were for basic, looking at basic medical laboratory values. We also, my colleague Jace Calloway from University of Kuopio in Finland took a lot of the bloods back with him from both groups to look at platelet serotonin transporter function. And we also did, with the ayahuasca subjects alone, we did experimental sessions where we had indwelling intravenous catheters, and there were, after they ingested ayahuasca, which was administered in one of their temples by one of their maestries or ministers, we would draw bloods every 30 minutes through the indwelling catheters. We also did serial measurements of blood pressure effects, temperature, respiratory rate, heart rate, pupillary diameter, and electrocardiogram. So for the several hours of the experience, we took copious measurements, looking at all these different modalities, and also with the ayahuasca subjects, we did these extensive life story interviews where we really got to know them and understood their histories, their backgrounds, how they came into this ayahuasca church, what their initial experiences were, and the like, and published a number of papers in the mainstream psychiatric, medical, and neuroscience literatures.
What were some of the conclusions that you found?
Sure. Well, number one, we found these were very high functioning people. They were functioning very well. Not all of them, however, had functioned well in the past. When we did the psychiatric diagnostic interviews, we not only were examining for the presence of current psychopathology, but we were looking at their past histories as well, and we found a number of these people had extensive histories of alcohol abuse, drug abuse, mood dysregulation disorders, antisocial behaviors, but prior to their entry into the ayahuasca church. But after they joined this particular ayahuasca religion, the UDV, and participated in their regularly scheduled ceremonies, they appeared to rather dramatically remit from their psychopathologic syndromes. Their use of alcohol, in our subjects at least, stopped entirely. They also stopped using other drugs. Their mood regulation appeared to normalize to a great degree. And whatever other symptoms, again, there seemed to be a general normalization effect. There seemed to be very low existing, presence of serious psychiatric symptoms in how they presented currently, which was rather dramatic given how disturbing much of their past history was. These individuals, some of whom came from very, very difficult backgrounds, who really were struggling, many of them became very successful out in the world and were really the pillars of the community. It was quite quite remarkable. I remember talking to one individual who had a big scar across his face, which was from a knife fight when he was a young man. This guy had also served some time in prison and had not been a good father or husband. He had subsequently gone on to become quite successful with his own business, really had become a very responsible parent, responsible husband. He was really considered one of the the pillars of the community. So they're quite dramatic. So that was one finding. We also found when we did testing for neuropsychological function, we actually found that and this was after our subjects had agreed not to participate in ayahuasca sessions for about a month. So it was kind of baseline neuropsych measures. We found they tested very, very well. They, in fact, on some of the subtests, they scored better than our non-ayahuasca exposed controls. We also found differences on their personality testing. The ayahuasca subjects were more prone to take some risks, were more sociable, were drawn more to novel experience than the non-ayahuasca exposed controls. And then with Calloway's workups of these of the blood work for platelet serotonin transporter function, he found actually an interesting finding of increased density of the transporter, which was not what we were expecting, but what might actually, just from a speculative point of view, could be a model for some of its positive effects on mood regulation. So, it remains to be seen. There certainly needs to be more research done in this area, but we thought our preliminary work is creates a good foundation, a good jumping off point for perhaps some work in the future. And there has been some work done in Spain, which is worth talking about. Jordi Riba, a research psychologist and pharmacologist in Spain, has done some very nice work, and some scattered work elsewhere. So I think it's a field which may take on some greater and growing importance in the future. I should also mention that the second series of studies we did in 2001 was at the request of the Brazilian judiciary, who wanted us to do a workup of adolescents, teenagers, who participated with their parents in religious ceremony. In Brazil, the babies are, women take ayahuasca during pregnancy and even during childbirth. Babies are baptized with it, just with a little few drops in an eyedropper, but then by and large are not exposed to ayahuasca until they hit puberty, and then they are allowed, if they would like, it's entirely their decision, but they are allowed to participate along with their parents in these religious ceremonies. But ayahuasca has been legal in Brazil in religious context since 1987, in the early 2000s there was some question as to what are the effects on young people and on development. So we were asked to do a workup of adolescents who were exposed. So we ended up evaluating, I think, about 50 kids along with 50 matched controls who had never been exposed to ayahuasca, and found by and large, fairly good psychological health profile, good medical health profile. These kids actually seemed to be less prone to engage in substance misuse and substance experimentation and alcohol experimentation compared to the non-ayahuasca using control. So by and large, we found some assurance that these kids were not being harmed by their participation in these religious ceremonies that use ayahuasca as a psychoactive sacrament.
Are you familiar with Professor Benny Shannon's work?
Yeah, somewhat. I've met him at some meetings. He's an Israeli psychologist who's, been for the last 15 years or so, has done a lot of firsthand investigation of ayahuasca and a great number of interviews of people who had taken ayahuasca. He's written a bit on this.
Okay, and have you read his Antipodes of the Mind?
I've read parts of it. I don't think I've read it cover to cover.
Okay.
I've read some of it.
Well, in Benny Shannon's work, he argues that basically that he was unable to prove that the ayahuasca experience was just a mere chemical reaction in the mind, that there did in fact seem mm-hmm. to be some phenomena that fell outside the realm of science. And he at the end of the book, he really brings science and the mystical toe to toe. Is that something that you have mm-hmm. found to be true in your own work?
Well, I mean, there's clearly something going on within the central nervous system. It just may be that we don't necessarily have the tools to measure exactly what's going on when a mystical experience occurs, whether it's induced by plant compounds or whether it occurs spontaneously or under the influence of other conditions. Just because there's still a great deal of mystery as to the range of effects and the what's causing them doesn't mean that there's not a neurobiological substrate to them. It may be that by modulating the underlying neurobiology, it allows the central nervous system to be receptive to a mystical realm. But again, this is an area that really is may very likely be a very exciting area for research in the future. But I wouldn't certainly rule out the value of understanding the neurobiologic substrate to these experiences.
Right, and nor myself. I've probably taken ayahuasca myself 15 or 20 times, and I've done various other entheogens as well, and I have to say that one of the most profound experiences I've ever had was with ayahuasca.
Right, sure.
I wanted to ask you, you've done also done research with another pioneering scholar, Marlene Dobkin de Rios. Could you tell me a little bit about
Right.
your studies with her?
Oh, sure. Well, I've known Marlene for almost 20 years. She's a very well-regarded anthropologist at the Cal State Fullerton and also has an appointment in psychiatry at University of California at Irvine. She's a very, very prolific writer. She's done a lot of work in the Peruvian Amazon looking at the use of ayahuasca by mestizo healers. And she and I wrote some articles in the early 90s contrasting the use and misuse of psychoactive compounds by young people in contemporary Euro-American culture. We contrast that with the use of psychoactive or hallucinogenic compounds by Aboriginal youth as part of elder-facilitated, socially sanctioned rites of initiation. Just contrasting the models and contrasting, really the outcomes. So I've done a fair amount of work with her, just writing, looking at the anthropologic literature. She was also a co-investigator on the ayahuasca study we did with adolescents in Brazil in the early 2000s. And she just published a book on ayahuasca, which it's a very informative book. She's got a good fund of information, a lot of knowledge, and it's a clearly written book. I wasn't wild about the title, which she told me the publisher kind of imposed upon her. What is it called? It's called A Hallucinogenic Tea Laced in Controversy: Ayahuasca in North and South America, something like that. The title was a bit over the top, but the content actually is very good, and I'd recommend it to people who are interested in this area.
Great. I've actually just spoke with her today, and I'm hoping to have her on the
Oh,
show
good.
here in a
Oh,
couple of
good. Very
weeks.
good.
So I'm
Good,
really,
good, good.
really hoping that
Yeah,
happens.
she's a fount of information, that's for sure.
That's the she definitely seems to be, so.
Yeah, and get her book ahead of time. I think it's a good read.
Okay, I will definitely do that. I've
Yeah.
actually got about five or six things from her here that I need to read as soon as
Good.
possible.
Good.
We kind of talked about psilocybin and you're leaving MDMA earlier, but what really led you into treating cancer and death anxiety? How did you what brought you up to that doorway? Was it just the
Oh.
government or whoever requesting novel ideas, or what got you there?
No, really, this goes back to my early interest back when I was, young in the late 60s, early 70s, I became aware of the research that was being done at that time by people like Walter Pankey, Eric Cass had done a lot of work earlier, and especially Stanislav Grof, who then was at the University of Maryland at the Spring Grove Research Center there. They were doing some incredible work on utilizing a psychedelic treatment model with people with advanced cancer. And then in the mid-70s, Stan Grof published a book along with Joan Halifax, I think it was called Human Encounters with Death, reviewing their work with cancer patients. And that was really, for me, Grof's work was, you know, inspiring and really instrumental in my own career choices. So this is an area I've been very aware of. Some of the literature on the treatment of advanced cancer anxiety with psychedelics is some of the best research that was done back in the many decades ago. So I've always had a wish to work in that area again. And in the late 90s, I was able to pull together some colleagues who felt similarly through the Hefter Research Institute, and I put together a protocol that I submitted to the FDA, and then I submitted it to other regulatory agencies, and then I had to go through my own in-house hospital IRB and in-house research committee, and there were a number of hurdles we had to get over, and it actually took us years to get permission, but I'm fairly persistent and stubborn, and I had to modify the protocol in a number of ways, going through each of these committees and each of these regulatory boards. But in the end, we were successfully able to get all the approval we needed. And through the Hefter Research Institute, we got adequate startup funding, and were able to conduct the study. The reason for it was really looking at the early literature and getting to know Stan Grof and hearing him speak of his work and some of his colleagues talk about working with cancer patients. It really did seem to be quite an effective treatment model, and these case histories were very moving. And so when the opportunity arose, we felt this would be a good area to work in.
Hasn't Grof actually moved away into breathing techniques now and not...
In the early 70s, his was the last existent study that came out of the 50s and 60s. The last existent program was his program at Spring Grove, Maryland, and it was shut down in the early 70s. At that point, government officials and regulatory boards had, we felt that I think because of the cultural turmoil, that psychedelics were too hot an issue to handle, and were not predisposed at that point to allow any studies to continue, and would not approve any new studies. And there was a good 20-25 years where no studies were approved. But then in the early 90s, I was able to get approval for the phase one MDMA study. Strassman in New Mexico got approval for DMT study, and Deborah Mash in Miami got approval for her ibogaine study. So we kind of broke the ice in the early 90s doing phase one, investigations of physiological and psychological effects of these compounds. And then in the early 2000s, there were three studies which were approved to look at the range of clinical effects. Mithoffer's study in South Carolina using MDMA to treat chronic post-traumatic stress disorder, Francisco Moreno's study at the University of Arizona using psilocybin to treat obsessive-compulsive disorder, and our study at Harbor UCLA looking at psilocybin treating the anxiety associated with advanced cancer. And then the one other study that was approved,
Oh, go ahead.
I should mention also an important study at Johns Hopkins by Roland Griffiths using psilocybin in normal volunteers, examining the degree to which psilocybin might reliably induce a mystical experience. And Griffiths' work was fascinating, and he got some very good results and actually got some very good press. and Griffith's work in particular has really, I think, helped the field, the research field and the clinical field, open up to the possibility that these might be very, not only interesting, but important research compounds to explore.
Well, other than you mentioned post-traumatic stress disorder, and you mentioned the treatment of alcohol and drug addiction with things. Well, I think you mentioned ayahuasca treatment with that. And do you have any experience with researching ibogaine yourself in iboga?
No, I have not conducted any ibogaine research. Deborah Nash did her phase one studies in normal volunteers in Miami, and then she set up a clinical program out of the country in the Caribbean on the island of St. Kitts treating drug addicts. But, unfortunately, there is no rigorous treatment research program approved or funded in the United States. So that's really, kind of an area that needs to be explored. There have been clinics in first in Holland and then in Central America and then in Western Canada where ibogaine was used to treat addiction, but these programs have often not, there have been problems and they haven't continued and there's minimal, data coming out of them as to the range of therapeutic efficacy and the safety parameters. And there are some concerns about safety with ibogaine, I might say. I do know of a few cases of severe, actually fatal cardiac arrhythmias. And there is, one has to be very careful and one needs to really, these compounds need to be administered by people who have both medical expertise and also who have the requisite skills to, psychotherapeutic skills, specifically being able to facilitate these kinds of experiences. Remember, we don't have formal training programs any longer for psychedelic facilitators. So again, it's but with ibogaine, there is a range of physiological or effects, which, and you do have to be cognizant of the range of medical risk. So that's my take on ibogaine.
How can plants and these entheogens, these suppressed medicines, come to help people in their everyday lives? And what might the average person expect to gain from a single session?
Well, these are, in many respects, these are fascinating compounds. The plants, likely were utilized by our most distant ancestors. I mean, there's evidence that plant hallucinogens were used by the earliest civilizations. In fact, just last week, there was a fascinating news article coming out of an archaeological find in islands off of the coast of South America, where mummies were, preserved bodies of people from 2,000 to 3,000 years ago, were excavated and were subjected to, scientific analysis. And they did hair analysis, and hair is actually a, you can find the residue or, signs of metabolites of various drugs that may have been ingested even weeks before or possibly even months before. The hair is either taken, from the individual or the individual dies. And they found evidence in the hair of these mummies, these thousands of year old mummies, of Harmala alkaloids, which are part of the active chemical constituency of ayahuasca. So this is actually the first direct proof that humans used ayahuasca going back thousands of years, you know, in South America, or and here was off the coast of South America, but within boating distance from the coast. So, you know, these are perhaps the most ancient of medicines. And there's no doubt that, you know, even our most primitive, you know, forebears would have been cognizant of the range of effects of the different plant life that grew in their area. And the plants that would induce these visionary states were, of course, viewed with great fascination and employed, you know, for one would imagine for purposes of healing and divination and exploring perhaps their own spiritual system at that time. So I believe they're among our most ancient medicines. So, you know, in today's world, of course, we're now, you know, decades after the wild, tumultuous 60s when psychedelics hit the culture, and the culture wasn't really equipped to optimally handle the entry of these compounds into wide use. You know, today my approach is to look at it, you know, from what may their potential be as facilitators of therapeutic experience under optimal conditions, which first and foremost must, you know, include that they would be sanctioned, that they would be, you know, permissible. And one can only do that at this point through a medical research approach. But, you know, there is a potential that these compounds might have benefit for individuals who suffer from particular conditions that may not be that amenable to conventional treatments. And kind of I went through that before, like, you know, drug addiction or alcoholism.
Has anybody ever been cured of any disease that we know of by the use of entheogenic substances?
Well, you're talking about medical?
Sure.
Illness? Not psychiatric?
Not psychiatric,
medical?
Yes.
Well, I mean, one hears of anecdotal stories. I've not seen any rigorous study of this, but, you know, anecdotally, you know, one hears all sorts of things. I'm not sure I'd make too much of it at this point, but, you know, certain conditions like autoimmune disorders might be worth examining down the line when it's more feasible to conduct such studies. But at this point, there's no hard data to really talk about.
Okay. In a so-called free country, why do you think that these substances that have had such a history of religious and spiritual and medical use, why do you think that they're prohibited? And, you know, is it even ethical to prohibit something in a free country that's related to religion and things? And does that not impend on our spiritual freedom, too?
Well, there's a relative degree of freedom which, you know, in all likelihood exists. We're also mired in a so-called drug war that has existed for the, you know, some 50 years.
I think it's 80 years
longer,
now.
Perhaps, depending on your definition. Yeah, when, you know, Henry Anslinger was out there doing his thing, you know, demonizing cannabis. You know, certainly though, that one can make a strong argument that I would not disagree with, that you know, our drug laws have restricted freedoms, including freedoms regarding exploring spirituality. You know, there have been exceptions. The Native American Church had an exception allowing them to use peyote as a psychoactive sacrament for their ceremonies. But, you know, they were allowed that permission, I believe, primarily because the Indian peoples are perceived as also belonging to sovereign nations. So the sovereign Indian nations living within the United States, you know, have a treaties within the United States. But so I think, you know, the members of the Indian nations are allowed to do peyote, but, you know, other people from other ethnicities are not. Although, also we have recently had the case of the ayahuasca church in the United States being in court. You know, in the late 90s, the UDV was shut down essentially, and its ayahuasca confiscated by the DEA and Customs. The UDV protested that their freedom of religion rights had been violated, and they filed suit in federal court. It was heard in 2001 in New Mexico. I was the expert medical witness on that case, so I was very much involved, and you know, testimony was heard in court for several weeks, at the end of which I was, you know, I was amazed by the verdict from the Republican conservative judge. He ruled that indeed the ayahuasca church should be allowed to practice and should be allowed to use its psychoactive sacrament. And he also testified that there was no compelling evidence that the ayahuasca represented a serious health risk. The Justice Department appealed the verdict. It went first to an appeals committee in the, I think it was the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. It passed. The committee ruled 2-1 on behalf of the ayahuasca church. It was appealed again by the U.S. Justice Department, went to the full appeals court, who ruled 8-5 in favor of the ayahuasca church. It was appealed again, went to the U.S. Supreme Court. Arguments were heard in November 05, and the verdict was read in February 06, and the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, ruled unanimously that the members of the Unidad de Vegetal in the United States had the right under law to utilize ayahuasca as a psychoactive sacrament. Now, they did not give blanket permission for ayahuasca to use across the board by any religious organization or any individual or group of individuals, but they did specifically state that the UDV, the Unidad de Vegetal, could conduct their ceremonies utilizing ayahuasca. So there have been some positive, developments here.
Well, it just seems that in a so-called free country with freedom of religion, that somebody or that these groups would have to spend 10 years in court to practice their religion just seems absurd in the first place. And, you know, what do you feel about the possibility and the history of the religious use of mushrooms, and why haven't mushrooms, especially psilocybin, that are illegal in the United States, why hasn't anybody approached that from the legal, religious, spiritual perspective yet?
I think an individual or just a group of individuals really wouldn't have much of a chance, just in terms of how our legal system is structured. Why ayahuasca was different was because there was a formalized religious organization, a church.
What do you think?
That also had.
I'm sorry. What do you think? It seems to me that we need a constitutional amendment that instead of religious freedom by an established church organization, it seems that it should really be spiritual freedom, so that we don't have to continuously deal with these issues. Would you agree with that, or?
I would not disagree, but I think we have to, being realistic, there's enormous resistance within our culture. So I think we'd have to have a long view on that. And I think earlier you had asked about, I think that why is there such resistance to psychedelic compounds? And I think, by definition, psychedelics are catalysts for change. So, catalysts for individual change, group change, societal change, and this can be very unnerving and threatening to people who are ensconced in the status quo, and certainly that was the case during the 60s. It's my hope, now that we're moved into the 21st century and that four decades have elapsed since the 60s ended, that we would be able to make, you know, as a collective, as a society, we would be able to make more effective and fair objective determinations as to the relative merits of something along the lines of what you're proposing. So I think that certainly there's a possibility, but what I've learned over a lot of years is in this area, one needs to be very, very patient.
Well, you know, and to further that, I'm not sure if you're aware, but on October 28th, Professor John Rush published a book called Failed God, and he is arguing that Allegro's Sacred Mushroom and the Cross was indeed correct.
Right.
And
just
this week,
well,
I published...
That would be fascinating, sure. Well, Allegro's work was very fascinating in and of itself. It was slammed by the mainstream press and mainstream reviewers, but I'd certainly be interested in taking a look at Rush's book, and if he can come up with a compelling case for the merits of Allegro's argument, I'd be very interested to see that.
Well,
go ahead. Yeah, no, go ahead.
I was just going to say, and just this week, I too, in fact, published my new book that's gotten backing from a few university professors, and I get into the nitty-gritty arguments that were put forth by Gordon Wasson and Jonathan Ott against John Allegro's
right.
work, and we were actually able to refute all of the points that Wasson and Ott had used against Allegro for the last several decades.
Well, good for you. I'd like to see that.
Yeah,
I'd be very interested to see that.
My new book.
Where could I, is it on the internet? Or is it purchasable? Or?
My new book is available from my website, which is GnosticMedia.com, GnosticMedia.com, and the book is The Holy Mushroom, Evidence of Mushrooms in Judeo-Christianity. And
oh, great.
I've also been working a lot with Professor Rush over the last 9 months or so, and so his book, you know, we kind of timed the release of the books together. His came out about 3 days before mine. But
very good.
So
well, I'll also be looking forward to seeing Ott's reply. He'll certainly have something to say.
Well, you know, I emailed him all of the information and gave him the opportunity to send us a rebuttal, and he wouldn't reply.
I'll be patient. He's at least in the past, he was a very prolific writer, and you know. Hopefully, this is an area near and dear to him. So I would hope that he would enter into a dialogue with you and Professor Rush.
Yeah, well, we certainly hope so. And we've had, John Allegro's daughter has been working with me on this project for the last 4 years as well.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful! Well,
so,
congratulations. That's really good to hear.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Now that I've distracted the conversation here momentarily, but pull it back around here very quickly. Has anybody ever died from an overdose of psychedelic mushrooms?
Well, certainly there have been accidental deaths and suicides. That's certainly documented.
How would an accidental death occur?
In terms of... Oh, an accidental death? Someone was somewhat disoriented and fell from a height.
Okay.
You know, perhaps somewhat disoriented and took some, excessive risks in areas, something like that. Certainly someone who got behind the wheel of a car, unfortunately, that could be problematic. And certainly there are suicides. I mean, I was consulted on a case about 6 years ago on a big East Coast university of a young man who did not have a psychiatric history, who took mushrooms and went for a walk with friends around his university and seemed to have either gotten disoriented or made an impulsive decision to jump from a very great height. That was a horrible case. That was actually written up in Rolling Stone magazine. And I've heard of other cases in the last several years, often of college-age kids who perhaps got in over their heads. You know, the psilocybin, when taken by a vulnerable person who perhaps is not well prepared for the experience, who take who and the context or the setting within which they're taking it is problematic. I mean, sometimes terrible anxiety reactions can occur. Individuals may do something impulsive. Sometimes the disorientation can be of such a degree that people become actually psychotic. So, I mean, there's no doubt there's risk, particularly in cases where the set and setting is not properly attended to. But you know, that being said, when individuals are properly screened and properly prepared, and there's a good facilitator in an appropriate setting, then risks are significantly minimized.
Well,
now in terms of go ahead.
I was just going to ask you. Well, you know, in comparison to alcohol, which I think has 150 or 180,000 deaths a year, and I think what is it,
deaths
85?
There's no comparison. Alcohol is. Well, historically, the most toxic compound ever created,
and
the most deadly compound ever created.
And then on top of that, we have I think something like 85% of murders and rapes are committed with alcohol, and that's just
that's right.
And that's just
and about 80% of successful suicides there's alcohol detected on toxicology.
Okay, so in a comparison with 150 plus. 1,000 people dying a year from alcohol-related things, not including, you know, just the medical-related issues, not including the murders and the rapes and things like that. How many people would you say have died ever from psychedelic mushrooms, as far as we know, historically speaking?
Oh, I don't know, but compared to the victims of alcohol, it's a very modest number. You know, I couldn't even begin to.
Are we talking double digits, or maybe 10, 20, 100?
Sure. Yeah, it would. Oh, you know, I'm not sure. I really don't know. But it's certainly far below the scale of alcohol. Hard to say, since mushrooms became somewhat popular in the early 70s. Again, hard to say. I've probably heard about deaths. You know, maybe 10 cases, and one additional case I read about of an individual who had a myocardial infarction after taking a lot of mushrooms. Wasn't a whole lot of information.
So we're talking about, since mushrooms were discovered in 1957 to present, we're talking about maybe the number of deaths that occur in an hour with alcohol have occurred in the entire history of our modern mushroom use.
Well, yeah. Again, I'm not quite sure how to come up with an accurate number.
To quantify that, right.
It's a speck compared to deaths incurred by alcohol use.
Right. Well, I'm sure you can see where I'm going with that. I just want to make
absolutely sure
comparison.
Well, I'm not,
there.
Yeah, I'm not arguing with you about the relative risk. Yeah.
Understood.
Sure.
Could you discuss the psilocybe mushrooms LD50 rating?
Oh well. That's the amount of mushrooms. Well, that would refer to the to how much mushrooms someone would have to consume for lethality to occur. And Paul Stamets, who is a very eminent mycologist or expert on mushrooms, has said that you'd have to eat your entire body weight of mushrooms in order to cause a lethal physiological reaction.
I believe that
psychological reaction would be so much less. Yeah.
Yeah. I couldn't imagine the psychological reaction from that. But I think Jonathan Ott argues the same thing as well about the body weight. And you know, I heard somebody recently saying that an ounce of mushrooms or something could kill you. And I just thought it was the most absurd thing I had ever heard. So.
Well, yeah, physiologically not likely unless there was some underlying medical vulnerability. But you know, again, in terms of psychological reactions, even a modest dose could cause someone to have a very difficult time, could cause some degree of disorientation, and there have been a few cases, at least, that we're aware of tragedies ensuing. So,
and it really,
but, you know, but yeah, physiologically.
I would think a lot of that would be, you know, a person's own psychological well-being as far as our own society,
sure.
and we just don't educate people on these things. So when they take them, they get
that's
into
right.
a position right. where they're completely
unfamiliar. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah,
that's it entirely. When, for instance, the case I told you about of the kid at the East Coast University, more than likely he did not have much understanding of how to optimally control the set and the setting to minimize the likelihood of anything bad going on. And he took it in a big East Coast city, and I would say taking mushrooms and walking through a big metropolis, that would be an adverse setting. That would be a setting more with all the noise and crowding and overstimulation that would be going on. I think that would be a setup for people, somebody freaking out. It would be the worst place to do it.
I would have to agree with that.
My book.
Yeah, just recently, or a couple of years ago, actually, Dr. Martin Ball published a book called Mushroom Wisdom that I think is actually very useful tool for neophytes to understand what they're getting into and dealing with. And have you read his book?
No, I haven't.
Yeah, it's I find it very useful for those who, you know, as a reminder for experience too, but for those who have no experience, it's extremely useful. Let's see. What other benefits aside from psychological and the things that we've discussed, what other benefits have been found from the use of these substances? Obviously, religious, spiritual experiences, drug rehabilitation, and things like that, with some minor risks along
the way. Well, there's also some people will talk about how they enhance creative experience. There's that field as well. You know, someone like Alex Gray, has been very, who's articulated that very well, I think. You know, some others going back, its effects on aspects of culture, you know, music, you know, something that came out of the 60s was a heightened awareness facilitated by psychedelics of the environment. So perhaps the movement to be more attentive to the damage we're doing to the environment and rectifying the environment, maybe there may be some antecedents to that within individual psychedelic use. There was a great study in Palo Alto in the mid-60s run by Willis Harmon and Jim Fadiman and Myron Stolaroff, looking at psychedelics as creative problem solvers. They did some fascinating work before they were shut down. So there are a number of, going outside of the religious spirituality realm, or going outside of the realm of, psychiatric treatment, there are other areas which one could look at. Perhaps, another area which perhaps did not get enough, where psychedelics did not receive, a sufficient credit, would be in heightening awareness to the Vietnam War. What role did they play
in
ending that war?
And
facilitating not just the counterculture, of course, obviously, but also the anti-war movement.
I would imagine it would have had a huge impact on the anti-war movement. In fact, probably why they suppressed them so much during the 1970s.
Mm-hmm. That's been my suspicion as well. And having lived through it, I would say that's my recollection.
I was a couple of years old at that point, but...
right.
Would you say, are people able to achieve these types of experiences without drugs? And what type of evidence is there to show that... that a meditation experience is similar to the entheogenic experience? Is there any at all?
Well, not. I think long term, very serious meditators can can potentially develop some facility for navigating internal states. But in regards to the enormous power and potential to affect changes over a relatively short duration of time, I don't think anything quite matches psychedelics. I'd also say that the interest in meditation, Eastern religion, that you saw, blossom in the 60s and into the 70s, that a lot of that was catalyzed by individual experiences with psychedelics. And some of the prominent meditation teachers had early encounters with psychedelics, and many of them put the psychedelics aside, but it kindled an interest in internal states and led to their lifelong dedication to their own meditative practice, and in some cases to being teachers of meditation.
Would you say that entheogens provide the same experience, or is each entheogen, does each one provide its own unique and different experience? And
Well, yeah, I think there's qualitative differences from one entheogen to another, and certainly from the class of entheogens to other methods of achieving altered states, for sure.
so and the point being is that if each entheogen is really producing a separate experience, and each one is so different from any other, then is there really any way to have a plant experience without a plant?
No, I would not argue with your logic there. For instance, when Stan Grof was no longer able to conduct his clinical research with psychedelics, he developed a holotropic breathing model, which induces altered states and has perhaps some therapeutic range of application. But it's always been my sense that this is a just a a modest approximation of what psychedelics can induce.
Okay, interesting. Is there any, I want to go back to ayahuasca for a minute. Is there any potential for
Sure.
an adverse reaction with ayahuasca or MAO inhibitors?
Well, you got to be very careful about medication interactions. Jace Calloway and I published a paper in the psychiatric literature where we talk about adverse ayahuasca SSRI antidepressant interactions. The Prozac class, Prozac, Zoloft, Lexapro, Celexa, those antidepressants. And you not you, and also one would have to be off of these compounds, some of them for a month, some of them for a couple of weeks. And the risk is something called a serotonin syndrome, which can induce a severe confusional state, elevation of temperature, a lot of tremulousness, all in all, a miserable experience to go through and potentially dangerous. So there's medication interactions to be concerned about. I also would be concerned about taking ayahuasca along with any kind of stimulant. There'd be a risk there for severe hypertensive reaction. But also again, the same as with other psychedelics, individuals who are not who have some underlying vulnerability, who may be taking the having the experience under adverse conditions, that they may be at risk for for problems afterwards. Recently, I got a couple of telephone calls from parents of young adults who had gone to South America, had had a series of ayahuasca experiences, and had come back home psychotic. And over time, they appear to be normal. I'm in touch with a psychiatrist I referred one of them to, and he's telling me that the young man is gradually improving, and that was my expectation. But they both came back, appearing, manic and psychotic. And after taking a history, it was clear that there was some vulnerability for serious mood disorder. There's a lot of family history, individual history, and also other circumstances which increased kind of let, you know, enhance the likelihood that a bad experience would occur. So there, I mean, there are risks.
Have you ever, I wanted to ask you real quick, have you ever heard of a scenario of somebody not completing an experience on ayahuasca and therefore that's the reason for the psychotic episode because they didn't go all the way through or complete the experience, that something resisted the completion of it?
No, people deal with blocks and resistances all the time. I'm not quite sure I'm following you there. I'm not sure I've heard that
Okay.
per se.
Just one of my own little theories that I've
Sure,
experienced with ayahuasca
sure.
myself, and
Uh-huh, sure.
I felt like I kind of had an incomplete experience, and that I had gotten stuck in this experience. And then 3 or 4 months later, I went back and I did ayahuasca again, and it felt like I had completed the prior experience. And then where I had gotten stuck, I went past, and then I understood it, and I cleansed myself of it.
Yeah, good. I mean, we heard this in the 60s too, that individuals might be encountering a little turbulence and got stuck in something. Also, using certain medications to stop the experience, like antipsychotics, it's probably not a good idea to give them an antipsychotic medication. Rather, to help them through the acute experience, if they need anything other than reassurance, gentle reassurance, and just monitoring to make sure they're safe, it may be an anxiety medicine. A Valium class like Ativan or Klonopin in low dose might help just take some of the edge off. But giving them a powerful antipsychotic, like back in the 60s, people were being given, stelazine or fluorazine.
In your opinion, why has the war on drugs been such a failure as far as these substances and the entire approach?
Well, that's a big question. Well, it clearly hasn't achieved its stated aim of minimizing the extent of dangerous misuse of compounds. It's probably been in part based on misinformation and prejudice. Starting off with the war on marijuana is really a war on a plant compound associated with ethnic minorities who were split off and scapegoated as bad objects. There are a lot of hysteria went into that. I mean, there are a number of different ways you could approach that question. Is the what's the role of the alcohol industry in maintaining the drug war? What's the role of the pharmaceutical industry, which likes to think it has a monopoly on legal recourse to altering consciousness outside of alcohol? So a number of different ways one could approach it, but clearly it hasn't worked, and clearly we need to be looking at saner, more effective, and more humane alternatives.
So, what areas do you think need further investigation? Where do we go from here?
In regards to psychedelics?
Yes, and further research as far as
Oh, yeah.
clinical and your type of
Sure. Well,
research.
I mean, I'm hoping that established investigators at other institutions are going to perceive how potentially valuable this area is and get involved. And that's starting to happen with people like Roland Griffiths at Hopkins, who's now developing a study similar to ours, working with psilocybin and cancer patients. Also, Stephen Ross at NYU doing another study in this area. But what I'd like to see that hasn't happened yet, I would like to see some research protocols, research programs looking at the effects of a psychedelic model on chronic alcoholism. Again, alcoholism is one of the most intractable disorders we deal with, and it's an area where there's probably been minimal gain in the last 50 years in regards to developing treatment models. The 12-step approach is It was the treatment of choice 50 years ago, and it's probably the treatment of choice today. There's nothing much else has come along. I'd also say that Bill Wilson, Bill W., the founder of AA, was a research subject in Sidney Cohen's LSD studies at UCLA in the late 50s. And Wilson was very impressed that psychedelics might offer a more effective and safer, method to induce the kind of the mystical epiphany he had when he went through delirium tremens or DTs, which is medically very dangerous. In fact, Wilson thought there might be a role of psychedelic treatment in the AA model. Of course, by then, Tim Leary was starting to get attention in Boston, and it was becoming controversial, and the Board of Trustees of AA cautioned Bill Wilson that he should keep his new ideas to himself.
What changes do you think could be made from your perspective that would help the release the human potential so that we don't self-destruct, but rather so that we evolve past our fear and realize who and what we are as a species?
Well, honestly, I think these unusual plants play a role, and may really, as my friend and colleague Ralph Metzner once heard him say, he said, isn't it remarkable that through these plants, we can learn how to be human.
That's a great quote. Maybe I'd actually like to talk with him sometime.
Oh,
maybe
Ralph's a great talker. Oh, he'd love to. I've learned a lot from Ralph. He's been a very valuable teacher. So, so these plants hold, I think, remarkable potential, and maybe it's the emergence of these plants after thousands of years of being hidden from view, in a sense, maybe their emergence recently is nature's way of responding to the global ecological threat, or the global threat that that our species might not only wipe out humanity, but wipe out the Earth altogether. And maybe these plants are being suddenly re-identified and rediscovered as a way to help facilitate the human species to wake up and become more conscious and more cognizant of what we're doing to one another and what we're doing to the planet, and help us resolve to make change, effective change, so we don't wipe ourselves out.
And we've been speaking with Dr. Charles Grobe of Harbor UCLA Medical Center regarding his studies into entheogens and especially psilocybin. Dr. Grobe, what is the most important thing about this area of research that you feel people should really know and understand? What do you want them to go away with from this conversation?
Well, I think these compounds need to be treated with the greatest of respect. They were the ancient medicines of our ancestors, our distant ancestors, and we need to see them as medicines with a capital M. And they hold, I think, great untapped potential to help us ameliorate suffering, and also perhaps to help us to wake up and effectively respond to the challenges within which we're faced on individual, group, collective, societal levels.
And do you have any other closing statements?
Oh, I think that's about it. I enjoyed talking with you. And good luck with your own work. It sounds fascinating.
Thank you. I really appreciate that, and I appreciate your time with me here today, and I look forward to your future projects.
shrouding all the ground around me. Is this holy crow above me? Black as holes within a memory. Blue as our new second sun. I stick my hand into the shadow. Pull the pieces from the sand. Which I attempt to reassemble. Suggest who I might have been. I do not recognize the vessel. But the eye seems so familiar. Like phosphorescent desert buttons. Singing one familiar song.